Real leaders leave a legacy. They capture the hearts and minds of their teams. Their origin story puts the safety and well-being of their people first. Great companies ubiquitously have safe yet productive operations. For those companies, safety is an investment, not a cost for the C-suite. It's a real topic of daily focus. This is The Safety Guru with your host, Eric McCroskey, a globally recognized ops and safety guru, public speaker, and author. Are you ready to leave a safety legacy? Your legacy success story begins now.
Hi, and welcome to The Safety Guru. Today, I'm very excited to have with me Brandon Schrader. He's a motivational speaker in the safety space with a very powerful story. So, Brandon, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me. I always get excited when I get to talk about this and, you know, get my story out there because I think it can help the masses. And, you know, I appreciate this opportunity to speak with you.
Excellent. Well, let's start with your story because I think it's a very powerful story. From moments growing up on a farm, understanding risks, all the way to getting into the trades, and then we'll get into the turnaround you did in safety. But let's get to that later.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, when I was a little kid, I grew up on the farm around agriculture. My dad had corn, soybeans, and cattle. So I was around a lot of large machinery from a very young age. I was driving tractors, skid loaders, helping my dad and my grandfather on the farm. And, you know, one thing that I always noticed is my dad, he liked to take shortcuts. He liked to get things done quickly as possible. And my grandpa would always be like, well, slow down a minute. And it always seemed like my grandpa's projects always got done quicker, even though they didn't come out. So, you know, I had a little bit of both sides of that in me, and I'm not going to lie, I wasn't always perfect. No one is, but I had a lot of influence. You know, my dad was a very hardworking person, and I always wanted to be like him growing up. You know, but I saw from a very young age, the neighbor kid caught his arm in a PTO shaft, and I saw the damage that it did to his body.
Yikes.
So I knew that if I didn't take safety seriously, if I didn't think about what I was doing out there on a daily basis, there were going to be consequences. So I was very careful growing up on the farm. You know, after high school, my dad says to me, you know, what do you think you want to do? All my friends were going to college. I really didn't know what I wanted to do, but I knew I wasn't going to go sit in a classroom for another 4 years. So I start looking at all the different trades out there, and I came across the electricians, and I'm thinking, you know, I can work inside, I can work outside, there's good pay, there's good benefits. I really didn't know what I was signing up for, but I went down to our local apprenticeship and training office, and I went and applied in Des Moines, Rock Island, and Cedar Rapids. Those were the three big areas around my that had apprenticeships.
Sure.
And the first thing I went to was Des Moines. That was the biggest metropolitan area in Iowa anyway. And, you know, I could tell very quickly that I was out of my league. You know, I was an 18-year-old kid that had only worked on the farm and at a grocery store. And I was going in there competing with people that had quite a bit of electrical experience and life experience that I just didn't have. Yep. And, you know, that really hurt my confidence going to that first interview. Well, I knew I didn't get in when I left, but I knew what to expect for the second interview. So the second one was in Cedar Rapids, and I nailed that one because it was exactly the same as the first one. I knew, you know, I kind of practiced my answers, and I got better at interviewing. I got into the electrical apprenticeship right out of high school, and, you know, when I got that letter, I thought, I've made it. All I have to do is get through the next 4 years of 5 years of training, and I'm going to have a great life.
Right.
And I show up at the office that first day, and I mean, I was the first person in the parking lot, and I'm all excited to go to work. And I get in there, and the first thing they have me do is fill out my pre-employment paperwork. And then they hand me a pair of safety glasses, some gloves, a hard hat, you know, a lockout tagout thing.
Sure.
And we go through a book about 2 inches thick and over policies, rules, safety procedures. You know, this is a long time ago. This is back in 97. And once we went through that, it took about 15 minutes. They gave me an address with a, you know, and all I had was that PPE that they had handed me, and they gave me an address. And I go out to the job site, And I don't really know what to expect, but I noticed right away when I get out there, one of the first things that I noticed was people did not have these heavy duty work boots on that I had. And, you know, my dad worked in construction. He farmed. When we went out on the farm, we always had heavy duty work boots on. And my grandpa, every time he always went out into the tractor, he always had a pair of gloves with him. And I have these gloves, these safety glasses, and this hard hat on. And I remember I'd go to first break and nobody has this stuff on. And I asked one of the guys, I said, you know, don't we have to wear a hard hat and safety glasses? And he said, a lot of people don't.
Really?
Yeah. You know, this is a long time ago. People thought, you know, safety glasses fog up, they're uncomfortable. And a lot of people didn't wear them. You know, a lot of the journeymen that I worked with, they were very resistant. You know, I'll wear those if I'm drilling or if I think I'm going to get something in my eye, I'll put the safety glasses on, but I'm not wearing them all the time. And they'd give us these lanyards, so at least you could take the safety glasses on or take them off, but you'd have them hanging around your neck. But I noticed, you know, a lot of people standing on top of ladders. If the ladder wasn't quite tall enough, they'd go to the very top. I noticed people getting into energized equipment. And as an apprentice, I couldn't do any of that. I mean, I couldn't get into energized equipment
until
you're a fifth-year apprentice. Well, after I went through my 5 years of apprenticeship, you know, I was all gung-ho. I wanted to run jobs. I wanted to show the company what I had. And they started giving me more and more responsibility. And pretty soon, I'm doing service truck by myself and then running small jobs. And they gave me a large commercial site to run. And I remember I was pretty nervous. But I was excited about the task, and, you know, safety was not a priority to me. You know, I used to go to safety meetings and think, I hope they have good coffee and donuts, because that's about all I'm going to get out of this. I didn't really think safety applied to me. I thought it applied to the new guy. Anytime we had a safety meeting, it was always some toolbox talk or some box that we needed to check. It was never anything meaningful that was really going to impact safety that was going to make me think, you know, that pertains to me or that could happen to me. You know, for instance, I remember in the summertime, one time we had a safety talk about cold weather and frostbite. I'm thinking,
good timing.
Yeah, it's 90 degrees out here and we're going to talk about frostbite today. And or we'd have another one about traffic signals. Well, we're nowhere near traffic signals. And I would get frustrated with these toolbox talks because people would just open up these toolbox talk books and they'd read whatever the next week was. It wasn't like we're going to pick anything that's relevant. We're not going to try to move the bar. We're not going to, you know, I think one of the best tools that any company can do is report near misses and use those for your safety meetings. To me, that's a built-in safety meeting. Every week you can talk about near misses. Or I can go on a site and within 15 minutes, I can find something to talk about, some hazard, something that's relevant. But we didn't really do that. So, you know, I got into just thinking safety was a box check or something we had to do to make the office happy, or you better have your paperwork filled out. It wasn't really anything that I thought was going to happen to me, or it wasn't going to, it didn't really pertain to me because I was a professional. I knew what I was doing. And I, you know, at the time of my accident, I had 15 years of experience and I really hadn't had too many close calls. I thought I was good at my job. It was late in the day, 3 o'clock, I'm done at 3:30. And I get a call from the general contractor and he says, I need this cord relocated. And I go out and I look and this cord's running through some aluminum framework in the front of the building. So, you know, the only way or the easiest way for me to relocate this cord was to unhook the cord from the panel, pull it through the aluminum framework back out through the doorway and hook it back up. And some people, when they see my presentation and I talk about that part, they say, why didn't you unhook it from the other end? That would have been so much safer. Well, if I would unhook the cord from the other end, it was hooked to a transformer running through the building steel, through all this framework, 200, 300 feet of cord that I got to pull all the way back through the building and unhook it. And it would have taken 10 times as long. So I have this cord that's running through this aluminum framework hooked up to this electrical panel, and it's less than 50 feet from the building. It's clear, wide open shot. All they want me to do is unhook this cord, pull it through the aluminum framework, and hook it back up. They want me to do this at 3 o'clock because it's going to kill all the power to the building. I go out there and I look, and most electrical panels, they have a main breaker. This panel sure didn't have that. This panel was fed directly from the utility side of this transformer. So the only way that I can shut this power off is to call the power company and have them send it.
Right, which not at 3 p.m.
Not at 3 o'clock when you're done at 3:30. I know that I likely won't even get anyone on the phone who knows where this piece of equipment is, let alone get a line crew out here to help me. So I'm thinking, you know, I'm going to have to do this energized. And from the time I got in 1997 until around 2008, I did this type of work all of the time with no PPE on. It wasn't until around 2008 that I started hearing about electrical safety in the workplace, NFPA. You know, yes, we went over electrical safety and apprenticeship, but I thought that electricians' main hazard was electrocution. And I had seen equipment blow up.
Sure.
That really didn't equate, you know, I knew what an arc flash was, but I really hadn't, I didn't know anybody that it happened to. I hadn't really heard a lot about it. I didn't really know what I was putting myself at for risk that day. And this is back in 2011. But they gave us these arc flash suits. And, you know, I realize that not everyone on this that's going to listen to this knows what an arc flash suit is. But an arc flash suit consists of a balaclava, which is just a cotton ski mask.
Yep.
You have an arc rated face shield hooked to a hard hat. We wore 1,000 volt rated gloves with leather protectors over them, arc rated coveralls, hearing protection, safety glasses, heavy duty leather shoes. All this is in a kit in the back of my van. So I'm thinking I need to go get my arc flash suit. I open up the back door of the van and the suit's not there. So needless to say, I've done these type of tasks many times. I thought I could do it one more time. Long story short, within a few minutes, I'm flying to the University of Iowa burn unit by helicopter, hanging on for my life, not knowing if I'm going to die. I had a brand new baby. You know, I just don't know what's going to happen to me. Right. I'm very scared. My hand is half blown off, and I get into the University of Iowa and they wheel me in through this doorway, and I'll never forget my wife coming in there and just, when my eyes locked on her eyes, I knew this was serious. She didn't say anything. She just ran down the hallway crying. And you know, and it bothers me today. I had to live there, and I couldn't do anything about it. I couldn't console my wife. I couldn't tell her I couldn't be the strong person that sure I always tried to be for my family. I was in the hospital for about 3 weeks, and then I went to rehab unit where I was doing physical rehabilitation, working on my hand, but I couldn't make a fist. I had to have multiple surgeries on my hand. I had to have skin grafts taken off of my legs, put on my hand. My face was blown off. I mean, not gone to the point where I needed it wasn't gone to the point where I needed plastic surgery, but you know, when I looked in the mirror, no way did I think this was going to heal. I got very depressed. I wanted to commit suicide. I did not want my wife to be married to this monster. I didn't want this monster to be the dad to my daughter. I wasn't thinking clearly, but I thought the world would be much better off without me. I didn't want everyone feeling sorry for me. And I just wanted to get out of there and get this over with. I wanted to leave. Every day I just said, can I go home? And all that talk did was lead to more medication. I got through that very difficult time in my life. Mm-hmm. Because of the strength of my wife. And you know, not everyone has a family and a wife like I do. I won the wife lottery. There's no way I could have gotten through this without her. When I got home, you know, then the problems got bad for me again because I got addicted to morphine. Trying to get off of that stuff, you know, I have a whole new appreciation for people that are addicted to any type of drugs. I had some personal experiences that, you know, my biological dad, he was a drug addict. I've only met him like 5 times in my life. And when I found out, or I thought that I was addicted to the morphine, once I recognized it, I just quit cold turkey, because I remember when I was 12 years old seeing him stand out by the side of the road like a bum, and I thought, this isn't going to be
Yikes.
I'm not getting addicted to anything.
Right.
There's another thing that helped me get through this, and that's something that not everyone has, but
sure.
I didn't care what happened to me physically or mentally. I was done taking the medication, and I stopped. Then I get through all of this and I have to go back to work, and I'm thinking I'm going to get fired for sure. When you have an accident like this, there's a lot of consequences for the company mm-hmm. that you work for. You know, we got a serious OSHA violation on our record. Companies do yearly safety audits. Our experience modification rate was above a 1. Our TRIR was
right.
high. And you have to fill out all of these applications for all of these customers and all of these bidding processes. And it really wasn't the cost of the accident that really affected the company. It was the customer's perception once you fill yeah. this out for bid forms. And I say this during the presentation, companies like working with other safe companies. They don't want to take yeah. a risk. They're not going to roll the dice. If you don't have a good safety, if the company that you work for doesn't have a good safety record, mm-hmm. a lot of companies will find someone else who does.
Yeah.
And that I had to go to a lot of meetings, a lot of explaining, a lot of remediation on how we were going to how we were going to fix this.
Right.
And ultimately the company decided, and I think it was more of a charity case because I couldn't work with my hands. But they decided to make me the safety director. And I'm thinking, you know, how are my coworkers going to look at me? Look at the decision that I made. And I'm going to go out there and I'm going to push safety after what I did. This didn't make sense to me. But I had no other way to pay my bills. I didn't have any other options. And they're asking me to do it. And my paycheck's going to keep coming. So I decided to do the best I can.
It's probably a good call, because you have a way of advocating that nobody else can, right? Because you've personally experienced it. It's real to you.
This episode of the Safety Guru Podcast is brought to you by Propolo Consulting, the leading safety and safety culture advisory firm. Whether you are looking to assess your safety culture, develop strategies to level up your safety performance, introduce human performance capabilities, re-energize your BBS program, enhance supervisory safety capabilities, or introduce unique safety leadership training and talent solutions, Propolo has you covered. Visit us at propolo.com.
And I think that was the company's attitude, is who better to talk about safety yeah. than the guy that had to take the hard road and learn the hard way. But I can tell you, I didn't work for a large company. A lot of the companies that I speak for are Fortune 500 companies. I worked for a company that had maybe on average 80 employees. You know, our peak, we might get to 100, 110. And half of the people in the company looked at me like, I can't believe this guy has a job. And the other half of the company looked at me like, wow, he was pretty good at his job. If this happened to me, this could mm-hmm. happen to him. Or if this happened to him, this could happen to me.
Yeah.
So I really couldn't control what the people who thought I should be fired or didn't think that I should be in that position. I can't control what they think of me. But I had a job to do, and I was very, very focused on that job. How I was going to make up for my accident was I was going to deliver the company a big, fat, zero incidents for a calendar year. And to say I was obsessed with this goal, and I'm a very goal-oriented person.
Right.
You know, if I don't have a vision, if I don't have a roadmap, I already know I'm not going to be successful. Mm-hmm. And, you know, one of the best quotes I've ever seen is an idiot with a plan can beat a genius without a plan. And I put together a plan, and I got to pick the members on my safety committee. I went out and I picked six people that were highly influential in the company that I knew people would listen to. And we started having safety meetings, and we said, look, last year we didn't have a good year. The year I got hurt, we had 12 OSHA recordables. That's worse than bad for a company with 100 employees at their
peak. Yeah, it's bad.
That's bad. We have to improve. So the first thing we did is we put in place hard hats, safety glasses, and gloves. We're not asking people to wear them anymore. That's a condition of employment. If you want to work at our company, you're going to wear these things. And if you don't want to work at our company, you can go work for our competitor. That's fine. Yeah. But we are going to change the way that we do things now. And I had the buy-in from the president of the company, and the safety committee helped me. And you know, one of the first things that I did is I didn't know anything about safety. So I started going to as many safety conferences as I could. And I would identify companies that were much larger than the one that I worked for, who had very good safety records. And I would go talk with them, take notes. What are your policies? What are your procedures? How do you guys walk through the job sites on your safety audits? What works? What doesn't? And
sure.
I got invaluable information from each one of those safety conferences that I went through. I was networking like crazy. And I was very much out of my element, you know, from an electrician who works by themselves to go to these safety conferences and meet these experts and talk to them. It was out of my comfort zone, but it was something that I had to learn to do if I was going to be good at my job.
Right.
So I went and met with them, and you know, one thing that stuck with me was you have to create a lookout for one another safety culture.
Yeah.
And if you can't do that, everything else doesn't matter. And I really believe that. And I tell people that, you know, if we made every employee in an organization a safety manager or a safety advocate, we'd have no accidents.
Right.
But the reality of it is, we have to go out there and we have to be productive, but safety has to be a tool and something that we use on a daily basis. Can't be just something that we use when the safety manager comes around or there's a walkthrough. It has to be a tool that you use on a daily basis. And if the people that are most influential at the company aren't willing to use those tools, you're not going to be able to spread that.
Sure.
So one of the first things that we did is I started doing walkthroughs, safety audits. And I would go out and I would tell people, you're going to get one warning to wear your safety glasses, gloves, and hard hat. And after that, I just give your name to the company, and whatever happens, happens. It's out of my hands. But you're going to get one warning, and that's it. This is a condition of employment. The rest of the items we can work on. That could be a training issue. That could be you didn't know. But everybody here knows, going forward, we're wearing our PPE. You know, I went and did a safety audit, and I had a guy who wouldn't wear safety glasses. And he's like, I don't need them. And I'm like, well, this is your one warning. And he kind of blew me off, like, okay. Well, I found a few other safety things that I talked to him about, and he was kind of on my radar. You know, when you do a safety audit and someone gives you attitude and you find things that are not receptive to what you say, you kind of want to go visit that person again.
You should.
Yeah. It's not somebody that you're going to say, okay, they're all right. They know what they're doing. We don't have any problems over there. You know that that's something that's going to take more of your attention.
Yep.
So he got more of my attention. And the next safety audit, we found another problem. And the next safety audit, we found another problem. And these weren't things that he didn't know better. You know, he had I would say only 25% of my audiences do electrical work, but my experience as a safety manager was in electrical.
Sure.
And I went into this project and he's got all the covers off the panel, live exposed parts, and a metal fish tape in the panel pulling wire. I mean, he knew better than what he was doing. And this was the third time. And I just told him, I said, you know, I don't know what's going to happen here, but you need some more training. We've talked right. about this. We've talked about this and we've talked about this. And I don't think that you are an asset to our organization with your current mindset. And I'm not able to change your mindset. So mm-hmm. I think you need to go talk to management to see what we're going to do moving forward. And I was pushing for an OSHA 30 course, additional training, something, because, you know, this guy had a lot of experience and I didn't want to lose him in the organization because, you know, safety is something that you always have to improve. You always have to evolve on. Nobody knows it all the day one. Yep. And we had a culture of not so good safety culture. So I wasn't expecting to turn this company around in a year. I knew it was going to take time, and our employees are our greatest asset. So I didn't want this guy gone. But I went and I told the owner what happened. And he said, you know what? I'm tired of this. Your accident should have been a big awakening yep. to people that they need to change. And every once in a while, we need to have a sacrificial lamb. And I said, what do you mean? And he said, unless you tell me something that I don't already know right now, we're going to fire him. And I got very emotional because I blew my face off. I mm-hmm. blew myself up. I was in the hospital for a month. I broke every single safety rule in the book. And I cost the company hundreds of thousands of dollars in insurance premiums. And I'm still coming in and I'm getting a paycheck and you're going to fire this guy? I did what I could and they fired him and it affected me. Like, I didn't sleep for 3 days. I called the guy. I tried to meet with him for lunch when he was gone. But yep. the last thing a fired employee is going to do is meet with the guy who he thinks got him fired.
Right.
And I don't know. To this day, it still affects me that he lost his job and I couldn't continue to coach him and try to make him better because that was what I was there to do.
Mm-hmm.
But I can tell you, after that happened, it sent a message to the rest of the company. Yeah. That these guys aren't messing around. Safety is going to be practiced in our company. And we're, mm-hmm. yes, we made mistakes last year, but going forward, things are changing. And you're either going to get on board with these changes or you're not. And if you're not going to get on board, we don't have a place for you here.
Right. It sends a message.
It did. And I would have rather that message been sent through me. Mm-hmm. I don't know why it wasn't. But him firing me will probably affect me for the rest of my life because I should have been the person that lost their job, but I wasn't. After the first year, we went from 12 OSHA recordables down to 3, down to 1, and eventually we were able to get that 0.
That's tremendous.
It was, but I can tell you that I thought about this from the time I got up until the time I went to bed every single day. And when I looked at the work orders, I looked at the jobs, I came from the field. So I knew mm-hmm. what stage these projects were in. I knew what they were doing. I knew the employees because I only worked with a company that had 100 employees. I knew their safety habits. I knew who was going to take the time to do things correctly and safely. And I knew who was going to take shortcuts. And I tried to get myself in the middle of those shortcuts before they even happened. Don't even put the, and that's something that I think that I preached a lot in all of our owners' meetings was yep. let's take these safety decisions out of the field employees' hands. Let's plan safety into the job before we even expect the field employees to perform work safely. Let's plan and engineer safety in before they even have a chance to touch it. For instance, when we're looking at bids and we're looking at jobs, we know we're going to need a shutdown. Let's plan that shutdown for them. Right. For them. If we know we have an overhead hazard, let's plan 2 weeks ahead of time that we're going to rope this area off and no one's going to be able to go through here because we know we have this work to do. And that's where I think shortcuts happen, is somebody thinks, I have to get this done to meet this deadline. I have a short amount of time to do it. And safety kind of goes by the wayside. But with proper planning and the employees with the four, you know, every construction project that I've been on has a 2-week look ahead, 4-week look ahead. We're always planning. We're always trying to hit goals and schedules. Let's plug safety in there too.
Right.
And I think it can be done when people work together as a team. You know, one of the big things that I'm seeing now is people are, you know, if you don't have, if you're not safe, let's say you set your hard hat for down for a second, they're going to walk you off site, no warnings. Or, you know, you make a mistake on a ladder, no warnings, we're going to walk you off site. And that's not something that I can advocate for. I think everybody makes mistakes. The thing that I advocate for is if I see somebody standing on top of a ladder, yes, I'll admit that's a poor decision if they're on the very top of that ladder. I have a bigger problem with the people that are standing on the ground that aren't saying, let me go get you a taller ladder.
The brother's keeper you were talking about, right, is somebody else is watching you do it.
Yeah. Let me go find a better way to do this. And to me, that's how you problem solve. You don't know what's going through that person's mind at the moment. You don't know what they're dealing with. And maybe their mind isn't where it should be that day. But when you walk right on by somebody doing something unsafe, to me, that's worse than committing the act itself. And there's no better part or feeling than knowing that you're part of a team and that someone's looking out for you. And when someone comes up to you and they say, hey, stop what you're doing. That's not safe. I'm going to help you find a better way to do that. That instantly sends a message that this person is looking out for me. I'm part of their team and they're going to help me improve. But one thing that I see a lot on LinkedIn that I don't agree with is somebody will take a picture of somebody who's doing something foolish and they'll post it on LinkedIn. And you know, that sends a message that safety is just looking for idiots. And we're all idiots sometimes, but
correct.
when people walk, you want to limit that as you get older. I think you learn from your mistakes and you realize you're not bulletproof. Bad things do happen. But I really think that being on a team where people look out for one another is the key to safety. And that's really what I try to convey in my presentation is you have to look out for one another and being part of a team. And you have one weak link. The chain breaks. And if there is a failure, let's not point the finger. Let's figure out where the team went wrong.
I heard a few things from you. Like one of them was really around the safety committees you started it with in terms of getting grassroots engagement and involvement. You also looked at some hard and fast rules that were communicated, were clear. Planning, I think, is a really important one, which is just, let's plan this through. Like, if I think about what you talked about, your accident, it seemed like it was a last minute thing. Let's try to squeeze it in the last 30 minutes of the day. And so right there, there isn't that advanced plan to say, okay, what's the best way to do this? If you call the utility and it was planned work, they'd be able to cut it out probably. But not if you're calling at 3, expecting it to happen at 3:05.
Exactly.
And then the last one was really this looking out for each other, the brother's keeper concept, and really getting people instilled, which I think is a very powerful element. As long as you've got multiple people working together, right? If you're a lone worker, you're kind of stuck looking out for yourself unless you get a second that's there that's looking out for you.
I agree with that, but it does take discipline when you're working by yourself.
Right? Yep.
You know how many people to me, nuclear power plants are the safest place in the world. Mm-hmm. And I know people in my neighborhood that work at a nuclear power plant, and I watch them put up Christmas lights, and I'm like, I know you wouldn't do that at work. And there's more than one time when I went and got my extension ladder out of my garage and said, here you go. I think you know there's a safer way to do this. And, you know, most of the time people appreciate that.
Right.
And that's what I try to do is, you know, just go out there and do my part.
Sure.
And look out for one another.
So Brandon, thank you for sharing a story. I think it's a very powerful story. references back to safety on the farm and how that was there, but also how you got into trade and the environment was different. And then very powerful story in terms of the incident, but mostly in terms of what you did to pivot safety within the organization. And was it 3 years that you drove this?
Yeah, I did the job for 3 years. I wanted to make some more changes in the company. And when I try to do something, I want to be the best. I'm not saying I can be the best, but my vision is to always improve, always mm-hmm. take steps forward. And the company did not, they were good with where it was at. They didn't want to make a lot of changes. They didn't want to keep evolving. And that's a big mistake that I think some companies make. They say, well, we didn't have any accidents last year.
We're good.
We're good. And, you know, that's to me like a CEO saying, looking at their numbers and saying, you know, our sales goals were great last year. Let's try to do the exact same number that we did the last year, this next year.
It doesn't normally happen that way.
No, yeah. You always want to do better in business. You always want to try to increase efficiencies and drive revenues up. That's the whole reason a business exists. And safety is the same thing. You have to try to improve and do better each and every year. No matter how good you are at it, mm-hmm. you can always do better.
Agreed. So, Brendan, you share your story with multiple different audiences. If somebody wants to get in touch with you, how can they do that?
My website is believeinsafety.com. That's the best way to get in touch with me. You can read a little bit about my story. I do have some YouTube videos out there that I've shot where my wife talks about, and they show some of my family, and that video has been very popular. It is in my presentation as well. But believeinsafety.com is the best place to reach me if you would like to contact me about future speaking engagements.
Sounds good. Thank you, Brendan. Appreciate you making the time to share your story with many audiences across the country. I think hopefully it helps change people's mindset around how to show up for safety.
All right. Well, thank you for having me. This was a big honor. I know this is a popular podcast, and I very much appreciate being part of it.
Thank you, Brendan.
Thank you for listening to The Safety Guru on C-Suite Radio. Leave a legacy. Distinguish yourself from the pack. Grow your success. Capture the hearts and minds of your teams. Elevate your safety. Like every successful athlete, top leaders continuously invest in their safety leadership with an expert coach to boost safety performance. Begin your journey at execsafetycoach.com. Come back in 2 weeks for the next episode with your host, Eric McCroskey. This podcast is powered by Propolo Consulting.